Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, welcome to another Hullastabur Book Club. It's the last in the second series, and we'll be back in the new year. And I'm delighted to be joined by Maya Rose Craig, who has written a fantastic book called Bird Girl. Hello, Maya Rose. How are you
Hello,
doing?
Hello, hi, I'm very good.
Good. I should say right at the top, I've met you before, but about 15 or 16 or 17 years ago when you were a tiny child. I know I was at school with your dad, Chris.
Yes, I think you're revealing your age a bit there, but yeah.
Well, I am very old. It's the Kings of Wessex Old Boy Network has finally pulled off something good. But I have to say, the book you've written, Bird Girl, is fantastic, and you're doing incredibly well. We're very honoured to have you. I wish I could tell you some stuff about your dad, but I can't remember anything too scurrilous. It's so long ago. What I didn't know was that he seemed quite cool at school.
You clearly didn't hear about the birds then.
He did not mention the bird watching, which is what this book is all about. So look, Maya, you're the youngest guest we've ever had on the book club, and possibly on Hullastabur at all. And you're just 20 years old now, and you've written an incredible book, and it's sort of incredible to think that a 20-year-old would have experienced so much of life already. But you've travelled the world and done a lot of interesting stuff. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself to start with?
Yeah, sure. So I wrote this book, Bird Girl, a couple of years ago, actually, it feels like a very long time ago now, during lockdown, sort of the big P word. And I guess the basic fact that you need to know about me is that I'm very into birds, and I'm very into bird watching. It's sort of the nerdiest thing about me. And I feel like the bird watching stereotype, it's not me. It's always sort of a middle-aged white bloke. And so I've spent my whole life with people going, but like, why bird watching? Like, of all hobbies, why bird watching? And so, like, originally I wanted to write Bird Girl just so someone could read it and be like, oh, yeah, okay, I kind of get it. And then it all just sort of spiraled out from there until it became this sort of big hulking hardback of a book.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of more, I mean, obviously it's, a lot of it is about bird watching and birds and your various travels around the world to see birds, but it is about quite a lot more than that as well. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, the family does feature a lot, your mum and dad and sister a little bit as well. And you're very open about the family issues, I guess, and your mum suffers from depression and mental illness is the correct description. And how was that writing? I mean, again, it's I don't want to be patronizing because this book is fantastic, but at such a young age to deal with. I said I won't be patronizing, and now I am being patronizing, sorry. But to deal with, you know, to deal with that, and it's close to you, it's your family, to be able to just write about your family issues so openly is quite a big deal, right?
Oh god, I mean, the minute where I was like, I was planning this big book out and I suddenly had this realization that this was all gonna get a bit more personal than I'd maybe originally been imagining. It was like, oh my god. And then I went to go talk to my parents about it, because I did ask them, is it all right if I write this? And like, weirdly, my mum especially was like, she was more on board with it at that point than I was. She was like, yeah, this is such a good idea, it's gonna be so nice to get the story out there. And so that was all really nice. And to be honest, it was in some ways sort of very cathartic writing it was like getting it all out there. It's like, actually, this feels really good. A lot of things, especially like, there's a lot of stuff I talk about from when I was quite young, to just my mum getting sectioned, that I had never really understood at the time. So like, by the end of it, I felt great. It's very weird writing a book, because you kind of forget that other people are going to read it until suddenly it gets published and it's out in the world, and it's like, oh, people are reading this. But I remember, like, right as I was finishing writing it, I saw, you know, you sort of see these bits of writing advice floating around online, and one that sort of randomly popped up on my feed was one going like, oh, if you ever feel like you need to write a book for sort of cathartic reasons, you should probably just go to therapy instead.
I've always used my writing and my comedy, and I've just written a book about having cancer last year, so I absolutely understand the catharsis of it, and I think it is therapeutic. And I think what's interesting about this book is, you know, I don't think you'd have to be interested in birds to. I'm not that interested in birds, I have to say, Maya. And I don't think it matters, because your enthusiasm, I love anything where someone is unashamedly enthusiastic. I think there's a little bit of shame a teenager, you know, as a teenager being worried about what your friends would think. I think, you know, inappropriate shame, because it turns out your friends
did not care.
Are quite supportive. They don't care. They're quite supportive. They only care about themselves. They're teenagers.
Exactly. That's fair
enough. But yeah, I think anyway, you know, you're a very motivated person, and you've achieved some incredible things already in your life. So which we'll get onto. But you've been bird watching basically since you were something like 7 days old. I don't know how many birds you managed to see in that first week and acknowledge. But see, your dad especially was hugely into this community. So tell us a little bit about how it all started and what that community is.
Yeah, see, this is why I'm genuinely surprised that you never knew sort of about my dad's bird watching, because he is sort of on paper just an obsessive, and he always has been. And for him, like, literally, you'll talk to my gran and she'll be like, oh, he was 4 years old and identifying the birds in the garden. Like, he's always been obsessed. When he met my mum, she was the opposite. She was like a city girl who'd maybe seen some pigeons and sparrows in her time. And she was like, you know what, you can have this strange obsessive hobby when I'm not around, but I want nothing to do with this. And he sort of managed to wear her down quite fast. We know about 6 months, and suddenly, I talk about this in the book, but she had this moment where she was like, wow, I think I might also really enjoy bird watching. And then he did the same to my sister. So by the time I was born, like, again, my grand jokes, if I hadn't enjoyed birding, I probably would have been booted out of the family because I don't know what they would have done. Thankfully, I did love birds. And I did love birding. And you're right. I was, I think, 9 days old the first time they took me to go see a bird. And I've just been doing it since, basically. And which was, I think, quite a weird childhood because the birding community, like I mentioned earlier, is mainly middle-aged blokes. And then it was just sort of me in the middle of it all. And it was great fun because I felt a bit like a main character because they all recognised the sort of singular little kid wandering around at these bird-watching sites. They'd be like, oh, here come the Craigs. And it's like, I don't know, felt a bit notorious.
Yeah, and as you know, people might be surprised at how seriously birders take this hobby. You know, you might think, oh, it's you go out on your own and you might go to the woods and see what you can see. But there's basically, and especially with the internet now, there's this whole community of like spreading messages, and you'll get a ping on your phone and say there's a big tit in a forest in Cumbria, and you'll all drive up there. So you know your dad would wake you up, or you'd just be about to get to bed and you'd jump in the car to drive overnight to see a bird, as would other people. So it's a quite a full-on
absolutely bonkers hobby. Community I feel like a lot of hobbies do sort of degenerate into that. I've heard all sorts of things about the knitting community, for example, but like birders are a little bit insane, which is half the fun, to be fair, because you know it is really nice to sort of go on a walk and enjoy sort of the blue tits and the dunnocks and the crows, but it's a whole different story to sort of suddenly urgently get a message at 2 o'clock in the morning being like, we need to go now, and drive halfway across the country and turn up and there are like thousands of people already there. And it's just sort of, I know as a kid especially, I just thought it was great fun. And sort of As I've become an adult, I've sort of realised just how seriously people take this. Like, there are people who take in days off work who are, like, chartering planes and helicopters to get to, like, Scottish off islands. Like, it's very serious.
Yeah. I'm sort of fascinated by obsession. Mm. And, you know, most people's interests are obsessed. You know, even if you're interested in pop music, you sort of get obsessed with it. And that's, you know, viewed as being cool. Whereas train spotting or bird watching might be seen as being things that a certain kind of demographic would go for that aren't necessarily cool. But we're talking about 10,000 different species of birds in the world. Is that roughly
that is, yeah.
Yeah. And so you're really aiming to see in a lifetime, which, you know, having started so soon, you may have a better chance than some of the older members of the community. You sort of want to see everything, right? Mm. And it's basically impossible. Has anyone ever seen all of them?
No, I'll not lie. I think anyone who's gotten that close has died of old age. But I mean, I think the thing is, like, I think, again, when I was younger, I really loved all, like, the numbers, the counting side of things. Because, like, okay, I feel like I'll admit straight up, like, I am a very obsessive person. I've sort of implied that, but I am. And sort of I loved the lists and the numbers, and I had all these goals. And for a long time, it was like, I want to see half the bird species in the world before I turned 18. And, like, that was my big thing for years. And then I managed it, and it was incredible. It was, like, again, absolutely insane. And then I was just kind of stood there, and I was like, what next? Like, all of them? Because also, this is, again, when you're getting into the very nerdy stuff in the book, but there's the number of birds in the world changes quite a lot, which sounds like quite a weird statement to someone who isn't a birder, but there's basically a big organization who's constantly adding or deleting species, sort of deciding that they're actually like the same bird and things like that. So the numbers all over the place as well. So I feel like even if you started to get close to the end goal, they'd just keep on adding new ones.
They'd keep on adding. And ones that are presumed extinct. There's a couple of cases where suddenly a community or a couple of the birds are discovered. And so, you know, you have seen something, you know, you do talk about having seen some of those very rare birds that were thought to have died out, which is interesting. And, you know, it sort of goes beyond this this country, you know, and you turn into this incredibly well-travelled family. And again, as certainly as a preteen and a teenager, travelling the world more than most people would travel in a full lifetime. So it's interesting your parents took you out of school for some of this. So you were sort of not homeschooled because you weren't at home, but you were schooled whilst going around the world looking for birds.
Yeah, that was a very cool experience. I'm not like I think like looking back on all the stuff in childhood, it's sort of also when I say homeschooled, I think people sort of imagine a period of many years. It was about 6 months, and half of that was the summer holidays, yeah, which I was very disappointed about. I wanted a bit more time off school, but it was just amazing. But I think the weird thing is I kind of wasn't very well traveled in this way that I was later until after. My mum actually became quite unwell, and she started like sort of having depressive episodes especially. And there was sort of this period when I was about eight, when she was actually quite unwell, and my parents had already booked this sort of very expensive, very extensive trip to Ecuador. And it was sort of this thing where they were going like, oh, we really probably shouldn't do this. But also at the same time, we kind of really wanted to. And we ended up going on this 3-week trip of like very intense bird watching to Ecuador. And it was amazing. And my mum especially, like, it was amazing for her, and she had such a good time. And she was just so clearly observably better by the end of this period. And that's the moment where sort of the light bulb went off for my parents, where it's like, actually, bird watching is really good for her and it really helps. But also like as a family, like it really helps us. And that's sort of when it became a thing, and we were like, okay, that's what we're gonna do with our time and our money. We're gonna go traveling the world and try and see as many birds as possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, there's a lot of adventures, and yeah, it is interesting, the family bonding and the dynamics of the family are incredibly interesting in this book. And you know, and I like the fact it's not like, and we went birding and everything was fine. No. You know, we went birding and lots of things got fucked up as a result, but definitely the kind of move is a positive one for your mum. And you know, it's quite unusual, I suppose, for a child to spend that much time with their parents as well. You know, there's a point where your dad says, you know, are you wanting to come with us now? You're 16. Are you still wanting to come with us? Whereas many teenagers would be sort of desperate to get away from their family. But you know, it has bonded you as a family in quite an incredible way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, even though, you know, it was spending a lot of time with my parents, which, you know, trials and tribulations of that, we talk a bit about that in the book. But it's like, I think because there was just so much stuff going on at home, where like a lot of the time, especially again with my mum, it just felt like she wasn't really there. It sort of felt like that was trying very purposefully to sort of flip that around. Like this very long 6-month trip we went on was right after she'd been sectioned, and it was like it just felt incredibly good for us at the time. But I do think, like, no, I can't remember what I think. I'll move on simply from that one.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay. And I think, you know, but by broadening your mind and traveling as well, for you as a young person, you know, I think the very affecting bits are where you see things in the world that start to make you question the way the world operates as well. So, like, I had a very similar experience when I was a little older. I went to Australia, and me and another comic drove to Uluru, in the centre of Australia, having spent lots of time in the cities in Australia. And you see the actual Aboriginal people in the kind of shacks and being kind of kept out of bars, and the kind of I mean, this was in the 1990s, so I was kind of hoping that things might have changed. But you obviously visited Australia, you know, in the last decade or so, and it's still the same, and you're very moved by that experience. So it sort of helped your, you know, you become very big in activism of all kinds. But
I think because, like, I was very young actually when I got involved in like campaigning and stuff like that, and I do genuinely think that was just because of the fact that I was really lucky and was able to travel and able to see all of these. But I think also, like, just having this genuine love of nature and the environment and things like that meant that from, like, a very young age, sort of just, I don't know, I was very aware of, like, climate change and deforestation and things like that. And so then seeing those in real life was just a massive cincher. And I just, remember when I was about 11, basically, I, through a series of strange events that wasn't really on purpose, ended up with this sort of online platform, this blog, and the big plot twist was that people were reading it, which was very strange. And I just remember there was this one event, there was this oil spill in Bangladesh, which I'd heard about because I have family from there, and it was in these really important mangroves, you get like tigers there and things like that. And I just remember as a kid going like, oh my god, this is terrible, I can't wait for like the Western media, like the US and the BBC, to start talking about this. And then they didn't, and I was just sat there and it was like, why does no one care about this? And then I just suddenly again I was like, wait, I also have a place where I write about things and people kind of read it, so I will write about it on there. And that just kind of exploded, and loads of people read it, loads of people were interested. I ended up raising a bunch of money in the US, and I think for like an 11-year-old, like, it was such a strange experience to be like, actually, like, the world kind of sucks and there are loads of terrible things going on, but I can make a difference and I can help. And I feel like that was such a big moment for me, and that's sort of some of the one of the main reasons I ended up doing various bits of campaigning as a teenager, was just because that moment where it was like, wait, I can make a difference.
I mean, it is quite extraordinary, but I think also it shows older people's prejudice towards younger people, where they will have an idea of what young people will be interested in, which won't be bird watching, and they'll have an idea that young people don't care or you know, aren't interested in anything else. But you know, there is this there is this massive uprising really of young people who are aware that the planet is, you know, in trouble, and that they will be the ones who have to cope with the aftermath of it. And so, you know, there is, I know you've met Greta Thunberg, and you've worked in lots of different areas as well, but it sort of is, it's interesting that it's young people who are, you know, I look at my Twitter and I've got a lot of friends in their 50s and some of them are sort of denying that there's anything changing in the environment, despite looking out the window in November and wondering why the trees haven't yet shed their leaves. You know, it's very admirable, and you must be unusual in this level of motivation. Or do you feel there's a lot of people like you?
I think because it was like 2013. When I started doing campaigning and stuff. And I think so much has changed in a really nice, like in a really positive way since then. Yeah. In that, like, when I first started, it was really like novel and exciting that you had a kid and people were like, wow, like come and look at this kid who's interested in things going on in the world. And like, you know, and though I only knew like a very small handful of other people roughly my age who are interested in that, versus I have like such a distinct memory of sort of Greta Thunberg emerging, Youth Strikes for Climate emerging, this sort of explosion of young people talking about like climate change and stuff like that. And it suddenly went from, you know, it felt like people my age didn't really care about these issues to it being like the issue of a generation. Because like you mentioned, I talk a lot in the book about sort of, I guess what I'd refer to as sort of the mortifying ordeal of being known, like sort of the narcissism of being like 13 and feeling like, you know, everyone cares about what you're up to in your spare time. And part of the sort of embarrassment of it all was being like a teenager who cared about environmental issues. Because again, it felt really nerdy. It felt really niche. And then suddenly I was like 16, 17, and it was all everyone was talking about. And I was like, whoa, like this is amazing. and it was just such an exciting moment for me, as well as like, I feel like it made a big difference in the way that we do talk and think about climate change. Sort of just the fact that young people suddenly cared about it.
Yeah, I think what's lovely about the book is that, you know, you do get the, your insecurities, which I think are kind of universal amongst, you know, and adults as well. But all of us went through those teenage years where you're worried about what people will think about you, and you're very open and honest about that. And, you know, this almost this dual world you live in, where you're out doing these big campaigns, but at school trying to pretend that nothing's happening, and you're sort of embarrassed if anyone recognizes you because you've done a lot of media. There's so many things that you've done, Maya, that are incredible. You're the youngest Briton to receive an honorary doctorate, which is incredible. You're currently studying at Cambridge University, I should say, as well. So those 6 months out being homeschooled didn't do you any harm in terms of your career. You've done TED Talks. You're obviously also very interested in, there's some great stuff about trying to open up nature and the world to people from different backgrounds and different ethnic backgrounds. Your mum's from Bangladesh, or your family are from Bangladesh on your mum's side. So you're kind of aware of this. There's a organisation you started called Black to Nature.
Yeah.
Which again, not... You know, there's so much stuff you've done. Tell us a bit about Black to Nature and what that does.
I think, like, Black to Nature is another weird one where it didn't really start out on purpose, in that, like, the original form of what now became Black to Nature was me being, like, 13. I had just found out that in America they have camps, summer camps for like every hobby under the sun, including nature. And I was like, there's nothing like that in the UK. I want to be able to spend like a few days hanging out with kids with the same hobbies as me. Like that was literally it. And I was like, I organized a weekend nature camp, and I actually did very well. Like loads and loads of people signed up. And I noticed that everyone who had signed up apart from me was like a white teenage boy. And like, I'd always known that there was no one who really looked like me or my sister or my mum, like out and about in nature or the outdoors. But I feel like for some reason, it being my thing, like my event, that sort of was perpetuating the same problem. I was like, right, you know, that's not acceptable. And it's sort of, I did a bit of a 180, and I was like, instead, I'm going to go and get kids from Bristol, like from Black and Asian backgrounds, and I'm going to bring them out on this camp, and I'm going to force them to enjoy nature. And I kind of didn't know what I was doing. Like, there's a bit I talk about in the book where I accidentally overhear a conversation where like one of the lads is talking to his mates, and he's like, oh, did your mum make you come? And he's like, yeah, me too. And I was like, oh, I don't, what have I done? They don't want to be here. But it went really, really well, and these kids had a really good time. And I was just a bit like, if these kids enjoy being here, if they enjoy nature, and like considering it's so good for like your mental and physical health and stuff, like why aren't kids getting out? And to boil a very long story down, I realized that it was a much, much bigger issue than I'd realized. I started trying to work with various organizations in the sector, but they're all really old and really slow. And eventually I was like, right, this is going to become a bit more of a long-term project than I was anticipating. And when I was about 14, so in 2016, I set up Black to Nature. And that was sort of my acknowledgement that this was something that I was going to be talking about for a long time. And I'm still talking about it, so...
But it's great. I mean, you know, and also, wow, that, you know, so many people, you know, so many people would just think I can't do anything. You know, it's interesting, at the time recording, I've just spoken to Joe Lycett, and he's doing this thing trying to get David Beckham not to represent Qatar. And, you know, but people just go, there's no point in doing anything because it won't change anything. Even if he stops it, the Qatar won't change. But the way you change things is to speak up and let people know what's going on and make a fuss. And that's obviously what's really happening with all the climate protests now, which obviously some people don't like and some people understand. But, you know, you don't get anywhere without making a fuss, and you don't get anywhere unless you actually go there and do it yourself. But it is pretty impressive to be a teenager and, you know, I know you have the support of your parents, but equally you have to support your parents as well, as they struggle with their own issues. So it's, you know, it's yeah, no, it's absolutely incredible.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You say it's good for your health and your mental health, though on one of your trips, you did have a slight, not health issue exactly, but yeah, I'd like you to talk a little bit about what happened to your head.
Oh my God.
And what...
Tell us a little bit about that. This is one of my favourite stories from the book, and anyone I've told it to goes slightly green. But basically... So you mentioned before that sort of these trips don't always go smoothly, which like we had no clue what we're doing, especially when I was younger. And there was this one time when I was about 8, we went to Ghana for like during my February half term. And we were looking for this really rare bird that you had to sort of sit very quietly and wait very quietly and not really move. And because I was a kid, I was really bored. So I started like poking around in the dirt and the mud. And my mum was like, Maya, don't do that. You'll like pick something up. And I was like, then I started sort of doing it more aggressively because it was like, don't tell me not to mess around in the mud. And about a day later, there was a very itchy lump on the back of my head. And my parents thought it was a mosquito bite that had got a bit affected. So they pulled the hair out the middle. And then the hole from that hair just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was so painful. And they just didn't know what to do. And they're a bit like, we're here now. We're bird watching. So we'll deal with it when we get back to the UK. Which wasn't for another good few days later. but it was like, yeah, fine, whatever. And they did try and peer in a few times, like peer in, because this hole had gotten quite big, and they just decided it must have gotten a bit infected. By the time we got back to the UK, I was literally sobbing from the pain of this just whole lump thing in the back of my head. So we went straight to the GP. There were concerns enough that we managed to like skip the line, which isn't, you know, NHS. And the doctor, when he pulled out his sort of magnifying glass thing and peered at the back of my head, he made a noise. He was so excited about whatever was going on. And my dad, who was sort of peering over as well, I get like he turned genuinely green, like a color that I didn't know like human beings turned outside of cartoons. Like he went green, and I was like, what is going on back there? And the doctor, again delighted, was like, he was so pleased to inform me that I had a ginormous maggot that I had picked up living in the back of my head. And wow. I actually wasn't that fussed, but he did sort of go like, it's only a day or two away from turning into a fly and just leaving by itself. Do you want to just leave it in there for another couple of days? And I was like, I think I'm all right. And then sort of ensued, it wouldn't come out my head. It was like really firmly, like it didn't want to leave. And so it took about an hour of back and forth with this doctor and this maggot to eventually pull it out. And then he sort of put it in this little jar and he was sort of showing us. And my dad was like, please put that away. And then he even ended up sort of running next door to grab one of the nurses to be like, come and look at this. And she turned up and she also turned a bit green, because it was like size of my thumb, ginormous. Like, I don't know how there was space for that in my head. like, and to this day, I wasn't that fast. I I'm mainly just really sad that my dad didn't grab me a picture of it. But I think to this day, like, he gets slightly queasy whenever I bring that up. But it's one of my favourite stories. My hair still sort of doesn't quite sit right on the back of my head from where it was sort of 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, your parents may be sent to prison after this book, if the authorities read it. I also liked him taking you in. You went into South Sudan on one of your trips and cut across the border illegally. Well, there was no one there to stop you, but your tour guides were
very nervous.
Terrified. But yeah,
that was probably only like a couple years after they got independence. There's lots of things looking back that it's like, God, you're irresponsible. Like, but it's good fun. So.
Well, I think, you know, it's good to take risks, and it's good to, you know, as long as you survive it all, it's good to, you know, the breadth of stuff you've seen, admittedly, a lot of it is birds, but you know, and the experiences you've had, I think, make you. And, you know, it's very hard as a parent to let your kids take risks. So I kind of admire your parents for doing this, because we'd be terrified if we were taking our kids around jungles. We'd be we're bad enough in Sainsbury's. So but let's just talk about, I mean, how from a perspective of other writers out there, it's incredibly difficult to get published. And I have to say, the book is beautiful. I've been listening to the audiobook. I also have the hardback. It's beautiful. The illustrations in it, there's a few illustrations in it, they're very beautiful, and the front cover is this beautiful illustration. So it's a very lovely item to have. But as you're 18 as you were writing this book, how do you get to the point where did a publisher approach you because of your blogs and your high profile, or did you have the idea for this book and pitch it?
It's sort of somewhere in between, in that, like, when I was a kid, I actually really, really loved writing, and I always knew I wanted to write a book. And I think one of the chapter titles, The Uninvited Guest, which does refer to the maggot that was in my head, I think I came up with that sort of directly after the incident, and that sort of carried through right into the book. So there are sort of various things that had sort of been brewing for a very long time where I knew I wanted to write something. And something about birds, obviously. And it was only during, because I'd taken a gap year before uni. It was sort of the classic thing. I wanted to go interrailing around Europe and all that. And then COVID. And it was like, right, what am I? I'm locked in a house with my parents. What am I going to do for a year? And it was sort of at the same time, my agent came to me and she was like, do you have any ideas for a book? And I was like, actually, I'd love to write a book about birds. Do you think that anyone would read a book about birds if I write it? Because I know that most people think that that's like very dull. And even though I'm trying to write a book that's not for bird watchers, it's sort of the opposite. It's for people who don't bird watch. And she was like, I think we can do something with this. And like in the end, we went to the publishers, and I was just basically incredibly lucky in terms of the publishing process. And it was all just really lovely. And I think the only thing is, I'd never written a book before, and I'm still quite impressed to this day that I managed to sort of bash this out in a year. But I do genuinely, I thought after it was published, I'd sort of be like, oh God, I wish that I could like change this and this. I still really love it, which I feel like is quite a good sign.
It's normal to look back. I mean, I think you do your own audiobook as well, and that's the point. I mean, I say this in all of these, but I've realised, do the audiobook first, because you spot all your mistakes. So do it early.
When I was doing the audiobook, there were a few things that I was like, are you sure I can't just say it differently? Like, in the recording, they're like, no, it has to be verbatim. And it's like, but this is so, like, I could do this so much better. Anyway, it's all fine. But I think next
If I did it again,
Bird Girl Part 2, I think that this is sort of a final, because I think that's the other thing, actually. There are so many people who have been like, but why do you feel the need to write a, you know, biography when you're like 20 years old? And it's like, it's not. And I think like, well, I guess technically it is, but calling it a biography feels very strange to me, because it's not like I was like, wow, I have such a story to tell. I've lived, you know, such a life. It was more just like, there were like certain things I wanted to talk about, and but like it's done now. Like, it's not like in 18 more years I'm gonna be like, right, time to write a second book sort of detailing the second half of sort of the birds of my lifetime.
But... well, we'll see. Okay. I mean, you know, I think for a 20-year-old, you have lived a very impressive life. So I don't think it's out of the question that you should write an autobiography. But it is, you know, it's unusual for a teenager to get a book deal. Mm. It does happen. It's happened to people like, I think Caitlin Moran was writing books early. Mm. There's a couple of people who got very early book deals, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't work out, or it's the only thing that they do. But it just feels to me, you know, you're so driven, and I'm not going to say sure of yourself, because you're not, because you're full of insecurities and you're full of the usual things that people are, but it's actually the motivation to get out there and do it, because it is, you know, I'm a writer, mm. that's my job, and writing a book is the hardest thing about being a writer. It's the hardest thing to do as a writer, and so to manage to do that, again, I'd say so early in your career, but as you say, you've been writing a blog for 9 years, so it's not that early in your career, but it's incredibly impressive, and very impressive to be published, you know, published by, it's not a self-published book, this is a book published by a publisher, so it's you know, you should be very proud of yourself.
Thank you.
You might get a book from someone and think, oh yeah, they haven't really, you know, often with showbiz personalities, they may be a big pop star and they haven't really done anything in their life. So you get a lot of stuff. And some older people as well, you get a lot of stuff in their biographies, their autobiographies that are not worth listening to. But this is all very interesting, because it's, you know, it is that combination of something very small and, you know, and about family, and then it relates to the bigger world. And, you know, I think people will identify with you, even if they are not as prolific and well-traveled as you. I wanted to ask you, in your experience of all the 10,000 birds in the world, what is the shittest bird in the world out of all the 10,000? Which one is the worst one?
You know what? I get asked what the best bird is. I don't think I've ever...
Yeah, that's why I didn't want to ask that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Which one do you think, you know, I wish I'd never seen? There must be one that just isn't as good as the others.
I think...
that you don't enjoy seeing.
Probably. I feel like there are definitely a lot of birds that I've had, like, very shit views of after, like, hours of looking. And it's like, was that worth the last, like, 7 hours of my life staking that out? I think... I don't know. I feel like my instinct is to go for, like, some of the little brown boring birds. But I actually really love little brown boring birds, which is why I really like the UK wildlife, because we've got a lot of those going on. I don't know.
It's not fair, Maya, to make you choose the shittest one.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a few wrens. You get a lot of wrens around the world, and they all look like wrens. You know what the wren looks like. It's sort of small and specky and brown. And there are a lot of them, and I've spent so many hours of my life looking for all these wrens. It's worth it. Like, I'll spend more hours looking for more. But, like, I think those are definitely some of the ones where it's like you see them and you're like, okay, cool. Like, that.
And how, when you're spotting stuff, because I used to do, my hobby used to be spotting all the UK number plates in advancing numerical order from 1 to 999. They changed. This is before you were born. Sometimes I thought I'd seen like a 654, and then I go, but was it definitely, or was there something? How sure do you have to be, and how sure can you be that you've spotted the bird that you think you've spotted, when so many of them are pretty similar?
You see, but I'd probably get a bit crucified by certain birders for even suggesting that these birds are similar. Like, no, I think it is hard sometimes. Like, I do talk a bit in the book about having like bird guides with us sometimes and stuff like that, and they are like truly magical people, because they'll hear like half a second of a song and they'll be like, oh, of course, that was so-and-so, let's go look for it in the jungle. And it's like, how? So there's a lot of that going on as well, which I think definitely is needed, because, oh, like, you get all sorts of things. Like, there are birds that pretend to be other birds and like mimic their calls. There are birds that are like, you can only tell apart by their call or like a slight marking on the third feather of their wing, you know, like it does all get very, very detailed. And so you sort of, I think in situations like that, it's quite nice to have an expert with you, which is not us in that scenario.
And do you think this is going to, is it going to be something you that is lifelong? Do you think there's any chance of you sort of getting into your 20s and thinking, you know, I'm not doing this anymore? Are there still birds that you're desperate to see that you haven't seen?
Oh God, I guess to answer the first half, like, I think I probably definitely will be birding forever. And I think, like, again, just because I started doing it so young, it would be so weird to not be birding. But also, like, bird watching isn't just like flying to various jungles to see various birds. Like, I drive my mates at uni a bit nuts sometimes because they'll sort of be walking with me or like sat with me somewhere, and I'll just sort of be looking off to the side, and they'll know that I'm not listening anymore. I'm looking at whatever's just flown past. So I think I in some shape or form, I will always be birding. But I think weirdly, I don't have a big target bird at the moment. In that, when I was about 8, like, I decided the bird I wanted to see most in the world was this bird called a harpy eagle. It's like, it's such a cool bird. It's like, it's the biggest eagle in the world. It's got these, it sort of lives in the Amazon. It's got these massive talons because it hunts by grabbing monkeys off the top of trees. Like, I just thought it was so cool, and just completely failed to see one in Ecuador. And I spent the next 9 years, I didn't see one until I was 17. And it was so worth it. Like, it's such a beautiful bird. It's actually the bird that's on the front cover of Bird Girl, because I think if I had to pick it, is my favorite bird in the world. But I think I just spent so many years trying to see one that now I'm just a bit like, I feel like nothing could live up to sort of the quest that was the harpy eagle. I'm sure something will come about eventually, but I feel like the closest I've got right now is, like, I talk a lot in the book, very obsessed with hummingbirds. Like, they're probably my favorite type of bird. And a lot of them, the smallest species of hummingbird is the bee hummingbird. It is the size of a bee. So I feel like that, if I had to pick sort of the next thing that I really want to go track down, it's probably, the hummingbird.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, look, it's a really terrific book. You've got a quote from Margaret Atwood on the front, which is a pretty impressive thing to have happened. She's my favourite living author, I would say, Margaret Atwood. So well done on impressing her.
Thank you. That was a very crazy moment when she sent that to me.
A lovely quote. She does seem very engaged in the world. And so it is great that she's aware of you.
She's actually a very big bird watcher, by the way. I feel like I should put that out there. She's very into her birds.
Well, this book, it has made me look. And there was some big bird, you know, I can't identify birds, but as I was driving back from dropping my kids off at school today, there was a very large bird of prey flying over the field next to me, which there were two of them actually, and I looked at them, and then I thought, I'm going to crash the car.
I have a lot of moments like that, I'll not lie.
It is interesting, and it is interesting to focus in on nature. This book is a terrific read. It's called Bird Girl. By Maya Rose Craig. Do check it out. Also audiobook, but you don't get the nice pictures in the audiobook. There are some nice pictures. Are there any books that you're reading or that you've read that you would like to recommend to our listeners by other authors?
I see what's on my bookcase right now. I'm actually currently reading Trainspotting, which I feel like is sort of very different tonally from my book, but it is a good book.
This is a good book.
I guess if anyone's interested in any other sort of stories to do with nature that aren't just sort of traditional nature writing, look at that beautiful thing over there, like the book Diary of a Young Naturalist, which came out a few years ago, did very, very well, by Derek McNulty. Is very, very good. Sort of very personal. It talks a lot about him struggling with Asperger's and also being very obsessed with birds and nature and stuff. It's a really nice story. And he's also currently at Cambridge with me, actually. He's a really nice lad. So it's a good book.
Oh, terrific. Good. Well, I think we're going to hear more from you in the future, My Rose. Incredibly impressed by everything you've achieved so far. And I hope you're enjoying yourself at university and having a great time. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And thank you also to Chris Evans, not that one, for producing. Although he's offline at the moment, so he's disappeared offline. So
he's gone.
He might have died. Thank you very much. Thanks.
No, thank you so much for having me.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.